This is the counter question to the final question that we always ask. What are you optimistic about? What did you get a sense of what he was worried about?
I think everyone's just worried about uncertainty.
Yeah.
And the sort of the what is to come in macro, right? I think he was generally, I would say, pretty circumspect about what the Fed is going to do and how the macro is going to react, as I think everyone should be.
Welcome to Recession Proof, a podcast by Ramp. Join us for in-depth, thought-provoking conversations with finance leaders, executives, and investors on the current state of the market and what this means for your business through 2022 and beyond. I'm your host, Alex Song.
In the final episode of season two of the Ramp podcast, Alex and I are going to be discussing the best parts from the previous episodes.
I will say this, there's always been somewhat of let's be honest, an adversarial relationship between finance and basically every other part of the company.
You're telling me.
For those who are familiar with HubSpot, everybody might not be. We had marketing positioning like make marketing people love, make love not spam, right? Like attract, don't interrupt. We had very positive, affirming brand positioning. But that was a company built by a bunch of MIT Sloan nerds. They were just really, really efficient at managing cash and capital. I remember being in a meeting, and one of the units I was in charge of, I think it was nonprofits, had an LTV to CAC of 7. And the CFO was like, bring that down to 3 and grow faster. And I'm like, cool, awesome. I know what to do with that information. And to treat the finance team and the finance leadership as if it's an adversarial relationship, or to not actually proactively reach out to them, to me, the metaphor has always been like you're yelling at the person who's sitting in the top of the ship's sails, being like, hey, there's an iceberg up ahead, or hey, there's land over there that's just like filled with random gold. Like, why are we ignoring or not creating clear lines of communication and alignment with a partner whose objectives are fundamentally aligned with our own?
I would say overall, the interview with Sam was pretty interesting because everyone's going through this live exercise right now of rebudgeting and reforecasting, and particularly they're thinking through marketing budgets. And so I think the emphasis on making sure that you have a nice amount of connectivity between the finance function as well as the marketing function, I think that probably resonates with folks. We are literally going through the LTV to CAC calculation internally. We are literally going through the exercise of measuring and potentially compressing CAC paybacks across some of our acquisition channels. So that's definitely something that's top of mind for us.
Business is not that complicated, right? Like, you don't need calculus to look at a P&L and do arithmetic. You got to sell something that you charge more than it costs to make and some overhead. At the very, very first level, like, is your business actually unit economic good? If not, you better have a damn like super big brain like strategy on how it's going to like get good. And don't just say you're going to figure it out. There's really just two resources that all companies, all teams need. You need to have capital, right? Like, you need to just be able to pay the bills, keep the lights on. And the second and arguably more scarce commodity is attention, right? Like, at a certain point, we all have 24 hours in a day times 8 billion people. That is like the max limit of attention that exists in this world, right? Like, you can kind of print money, do weird financial engineering with money, but literally, like, the max attention cap of humanity is some 8 billion times 24 hours a day. So anything that can wield attention, I think, is going to be increasingly powerful over time.
I thought the discussion with Jeff was pretty interesting. I mean, one of the things that he does super well is, especially for early stage where Antifund really focuses, is just boil it down to its absolute basic first principles in terms of executing, where you don't need to overthink outside of building something that customers just desperately desire. Get to that point, ignore the rest, ignore the macroeconomic environment, and then just really focus on building a great business, and the rest will follow, which is simple, not simplistic. Because one of the things that we were chatting about is their competitive advantage in the competition for funding other companies. And so one of the things that they're really looking to differentiate themselves on is is the ability to bring attention. And that's a question that companies are asking themselves is how do we grab attention for ourselves, especially as startups are still being funded, even though.
This attention clip is very interesting because how do you create a moat around it? That's the thing. I think if you are in social media or you're in consumer TMT or whatnot, I think that's it makes a lot of sense. But like orchestrating a moat around that is very difficult, right? I mean, just look at how people spend their time today versus 5 years ago versus 10 years ago. The shares are completely different, right? Like TikTok didn't exist 5 years ago. And then, you know, YouTube didn't exist, whatever, 10 years ago, right? And then 20 years ago, it was all print media and whatnot. So I feel like this attention thing is valuable, but how do you create a moat around it? And maybe that's the secret sauce.
One of the other things that Jeff said that I thought was interesting was the compression around these cycles has dramatically increased. So where you could extract a ton of value from Google Ads, you now get 7 years, and then Facebook, you get 5 years, and TikTok, you get 2 years, and maybe Quora, you get a year. And then there's a new platform that you might get 6 months of value out of. And then you got to keep your ear to the ground. And so I agree. I think it's interesting to create a moat. I wonder if the second point is, what do you do once that has passed? And how do you continue the moat? Is that now then product? Do you keep investing in that attention? Or do you have enough where you can just spin the flywheel in the background?
Wouldn't it be better just to invest in a company like TransDigm?
Right? Yes.
Where you're just like, yes. There is literally no attention paid to it.
Yes.
And as a result of that, the buyers and the suppliers, you know, everyone is just priced inelastic because profits in the industry are literally regulated and they're well-defined, and your moat could be decades long because no one's really competing against you there.
There's another interesting company called Partstown. I don't know if you know about them. Distribution of small food repair, like food machine repair shops. Super, super sticky, super moaty. Do you care if you're paying 2 cents more for your fryer part?
Good times build bad habits, and bad times build good character. And I think when things are really great, it's really hard to think about the practices, the processes, the things that aren't maybe geared the way they should be, because they get papered over by the fact that everything seems fine. When things go bad, you sometimes go the opposite way. Things that are okay get thrown out because you're just so concerned about survival.
So this quote by Dan Chen is very interesting because it reminds me of the quote that always goes, you know, good times create weak men and weak men create, you know, like that. I think this makes a lot of sense, and it particularly resonates now, right? Because the good times, quote unquote, 2020, 2021, infinite liquidity sloshing around, infinitely low rates and a lot of funding, I think that's created perhaps a sense of complacency amongst some teams, particularly, you know, management teams and finance teams in terms of fiscal discipline. And I think you follow, this is where you saw a few companies who maybe grew a little bit too quickly, perhaps ahead of where the business fundamentals would have necessarily warranted. And we have seen over the last couple of months some pretty spectacular blow-ups. I think Fast is one example potentially, but I think this is definitely a sign of, this is an evergreen quote that is, you know, now more so than ever reflective of a sign of the times.
Alex, I think the question for you is, go pick one of those companies that raised in peak hype. How would you rebuild that business?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. I mean, I think some of these companies have to go through a lot of pain, right? If you overbuilt and you overhired, and if you don't necessarily have the right, you know, butt in seats, then you are going to have to go through a painful process of reorganization and reprioritization. I think that a lot of projects, well, I think a great example of this would be companies that had or made a business of making moonshot bets, which makes a lot of sense in a zero interest rate environment because literally a future value equals present value. But a lot of those moon bets, a lot of these moonshots are going to have to be shut down or shut off, right? And I think that is actually what we're seeing at companies like Meta, or maybe not Meta specifically, but maybe, you know, Alphabet and a few of these other guys.
There's a great Bill Gurley quote that I love. There is always product market fit for selling a dollar for 90 cents, regardless of the business. And that feels very apt to a lot of the companies over the last, call it 8 years. And so do you have product market fit if you're selling a dollar for a dollar 10? Maybe, probably. But bridging that delta is going to be tough.
We have real companies and businesses, you know, that are generating, you know, real sales and margins and profits in several cases. And so, you know, the advice, or I guess commentary I would give around the current environment is, we've seen the recommendations from some of the top VC firms, right, to cut back and be very careful in terms of how much you invest and make sure you get to cash flow, you know, to break even and generate, you know, EBITDA and all that sort of stuff. I would say absolutely the viability and survival of your company is most essential. So having cash on the balance sheet, having liquidity, having, you know, 3 to 4 years of cash is sort of the benchmark I look at. You make sure you have the runway to get through this period of time and to emerge.
I think Anoop's interview overall was just very interesting to me because he's so experienced. He's run so many companies. A lot of these companies are profitable. And what's interesting is that sometimes we just forget about that, right? Like most companies, most of the time, are meant to be profitable, right? You're supposed to be a profitable company. And I think profitability at the end of the day is the thing that gives you the most amount of flexibility with respect to operating, making bets, large and small, and having some amount of slack or flexibility around hiring. And it's just very interesting though, that obviously within early stage or growth or venture, we tend not to be that familiar with companies that are intrinsically just very, very profitable.
As a software company, sometimes you have less pressure on margins and you can discount. But with hardware, you have to make sure that you have good gross margins, right? You have shipping logistics that you have to worry about. And, you know, you may have, like, probably getting a little bit in the weeds here, but you might have to have like a cross dock and like all kinds of different things. You have distributors that you have to hold inventory and sell on to end users. You have import export controls that are, you know, you still have import export on software companies, but it's not nearly to the same degree as hardware, and especially in the security space, right, where the government definitely doesn't want you selling some of these things to certain embargoed countries. The complexity is much higher with a hardware type of product. And I think, you know, even with consumer hardware or consumer wearables and things like that, the accounting, the finance, all the processes around that are much more difficult and challenging.
I think the one interesting thing that I learned from Keith's interview is just his experience and his background, not only, you know, managing more software-enabled companies, but also Palo Alto Network in the early days, which was a hardware company, and just his commentary about how actually managing finance and accounting at a hardware-focused company was so much harder. That I feel like I didn't appreciate previously.
Did he mention anything about pulling those lessons into software? Is it easier after going from there to a physical company, a physical manufacturing company, or just physical goods, I guess, to software?
I think it was just the practice of being rigorous. I think it was just the practice of managing a P&L that was so much, I would say, maybe more sophisticated and complex than ones that potentially, you know, a B2B SaaS company might have to deal with. Like, I guess it is pretty interesting, right? Like, imagine if you're selling switches and routers, and every 6 months or every year you come out with a new version, right? What do you even do with your prior inventory? Probably, you know, record that as an asset on the balance sheet. And probably every couple of months, you have to go through the process of clearing that out, selling it at a discount, right? And monetizing inventory that's probably not where you initially marked it. Or maybe it is. Maybe you can mark it higher. You know, I don't know. I can see how the accounting treatments around stuff like that could get very interesting.
I'd also be interested to see how they treat that on the op side. Like, you're trying to sell a new product, if there is an appetite, how do you sell the back catalog? And just what is the operations around new cycles of releases for the same product? Like, that's got to create a ton of burden.
Yeah. And then I think maybe a final thing, if I had more time, I would have loved to have talked to Keith a little bit more about maybe the pivot, right? The pivot of the company from hardware focus to introducing new products and then introducing specifically software and then moving into the multi-product world. I think whenever companies move from one business line or one business unit to multiple, right? That is always the most interesting challenge. I think that probably resonates with the folks here at Ramp as well.
I was a customer support associate that got promoted into a sales ops job. And you know what I knew about sales ops when I was 22? Nothing.
Sure.
And we usually take smart people and throw them into jobs and let them learn on the fly. But I think that's actually super dangerous to an early stage startup, because the person and then the people surrounding them often don't know what they don't know. And so I think there's a ton of value in finding either advisors, consultants, or outsourcing some portion of this to bring best practices into the mix.
One of my key takeaways from Liz is really the focus on there is usually a right person per right stage, especially in sales and sales ops, and then really focusing on increased efficiency across your team. One of the things that she was talking about is really making sure on the more basic side, making sure that sales ops is tackling the tooling. Do you have 30 tools that your reps need to log into? And what does that create in terms of time just wasted logging into tools? How do you centralize that process? And really just looking at what's the funnel, what's their steps to execute? How do you increase efficiency across each step? And then do you have the right person in the right position to lead that function?
Have you seen the recent, I think this has been making the rounds on the various blogs and various podcasts, but have you seen the recent academic research that suggests that historically when salespeople get promoted to sales managers, that's not necessarily the most effective thing to do and most optimal thing to do, because the qualities, right? The qualities are different. The best salespeople may not necessarily be the best managers. You might be promoting in a very suboptimal way. Maybe my key takeaway from this is that the observation is true. The characteristics that make someone a good salesperson doesn't necessarily make that person a good manager. Well, this is true across functions, by the way. This is not just sales, but I don't know why we specifically hinged on just the sales function. I think that's a function of just the academic research, right? I think the literature focuses on sales, but it could be anything. It could be a very strong IC. It could be a very strong software.
I mean, think about an engineer. Yeah, I was literally about to say.
Maybe the solution is just a very strong IC track. The existence and the acceptance that you could be an extremely strong IC forever. I remember back in the day, by the way, when I was at Morgan Stanley, there were folks who were absolute moneymakers on the trading desk. And at times, I think there were people who even refused a promotion, because there came a time when compensation didn't necessarily correlate one for one with your title anymore. And if a promotion meant that you had to manage more people than you were comfortable with, some of those people would just say, well, I actually do want to just stay and just keep doing what I'm doing as a VP or as an executive director or anything that's not a partner. Let me just go do that and make a ton of money, right? The existence of that IC track enables something like that. But obviously, I think a lot of companies, and there are many industries that probably don't have that track available.
It's interesting because the individual person in finance, you have inherent leverage where you can essentially print money, right? Like these institutions are designed to do so. Where I think this is also true is in design. Like if you think about a great UX UI designer, you rarely want them leveling up, because there's so much leverage for great design within your product. And there's a very long, very strong IC track within design.
Interesting. Maybe that's the solution, is just to make it so that it's more accepted across more functions and more industries.
And more rewarding, Like there's more glory at the top for an individual. Because I think you top out.
Yeah. Make it so that compensation is only loosely correlated or maybe not correlated at all with your title, right? That might be the solution. And also making it so that the title itself is not necessarily correlated to the number of people you are managing, and have value generation and value accrual just be looked at both on an IC basis as well as on a, you know, management basis. And it's not necessarily one before the other. It's not linear. It could just be two different axes that folks are evaluated upon.
This is probably a hot take only fueled by Twitter and what's going on there. But there are a lot of managers who are not comped according to the output of their team. And if, you know, there should be, like, that is how ICs are comped. Maybe there's an opportunity to take a very hard look at manager output and comp accordingly. But I will say this, so that would skew the incentive to wanting to be a manager, because then you get more leverage. And I don't know how to design that comp, but I think it's an interesting thought experiment.
Well, first of all, I'll start with the end, which is advice. I would say get on a board if you can, even if as a full-time exec, because I think it makes you a better executive. When you're a full-time exec, especially in an intense startup or private company, you know, scaling a company, you can get tunnel vision. And I think having another company and seeing from a bird's eye view what they're going through gives you perspective, context, learnings, and you start building your pattern recognition. Right. So I would say as soon as you can, get on a board.
So Kelly made some very interesting comments toward the end of our discussion about how you can be more well-rounded as a finance professional. But really, it's true just as anyone, as a manager or just as an individual contributor. I think some of her experiences that really, at least my key takeaway, was serving on boards and especially working with nonprofits, and just having that giving you more of a perspective around your day job, which was very cool. One of her recommendations was just join as many boards as possible and help as many companies as possible with whatever issue that they may be seeing, because it's likely that you just saw that or you will be seeing that very soon. So I think one of her earlier experiences was actually working with Wikipedia, which she basically said was a very formative experience. I could only imagine. So I think that was pretty interesting.
That's super interesting. One of the vertebrae of the spine of the internet. I can imagine that she learned a ton there.
It's also sort of interesting because as a nonprofit, I can't even begin to guess. How do you even manage the P&L for something like that? You have to be break even, right? You have to be break even.
Of course.
You do, as a finance professional or a CFO or a board member, you have to have some sort of fiduciary duty, clearly, because you have employees and you have vendors. So clearly you can't just be entirely fiscally irresponsible. But then, you know, is your mission still to maximize P&L? Is it still to maximize ROIC and free cash flow yield? I think that's actually kind of interesting. Maybe we should record a podcast next season about how does it work to run finance or lead finance at one of these nonprofit organized entities, like a foundation or endowment or a charity or something like that.
The other thing that I want to pull out of this is like what she said on being well-rounded. I think it's the Silicon Valley narrative is to say, you know, index on your strengths, ignore your weaknesses. But there's a very clear miss in that line of thinking where you can pick up different skills experiencing different things. And so being well-rounded actually might be the long-term better play versus I am the best, the single best at this one vertical strength versus seeing many disparate problems.
Yep.
I think payments and fintech, it's a good place to be if you're concerned about inflation. I think you hit the nail on the head, Alex, where, I mean, these companies usually generate revenue as a percentage of the transaction value, right? So as the average transaction size increases due to the inflation, if you're charging a take rate, if you're charging 2% on whatever that transaction value is, you know, your revenues are going to go up as that transaction size goes up. I think there's a couple other key points to think about here when it comes to which businesses might be in a better position to survive an inflationary environment. And it's companies that have pricing power because of some reason, whether it's a strong franchise or you have a dominant position in the industry. And so as their expenses increase, you know, they can raise price to make sure that their revenues increase and maintain their earnings power of the business. That's extremely important. Everyone was locked in their house for basically a year or 2 years. You had this excess savings because you couldn't go out and really spend it. I mean, you spent some of it online. But so now you have an economy that's reopening. You have borders that are reopening and people want to go out and travel and move around and experience things. So I think you're seeing that shift back to services that's been in place for some time. Yeah. And it's more, I think what we're seeing is the spend in, you know, the discretionary services was certainly there, right? Whether it's lodging, you know, travel and entertainment, restaurant sales, we're seeing strong demand there. So those are the categories that are seeing that demand, but they're also the categories that might pull back quickly if we go into some sort of downturn.
The interview with Ken was very interesting. Kimmy, I wish you would have been able to sit in on this one. So Ken is one of the top payments analysts.
Nice.
On the sell side and in the world of equity research. There were at least a couple of things that I thought were very, very, very interesting. One is we spent a little bit of time discussing inflation and how as a payments company, everyone makes money in every vendor, right? Every goods and service provider, everyone makes money in nominal, not real. And so if you think about how price elastic or inelastic your customers are in a payments company, your customers are almost the most price inelastic because you kind of just have to pay, you know, you're literally paying, you know, as a percent of the goods and services. So we talked a little bit about just how some industries and some businesses are a little bit more inflation resilient. So that was pretty interesting. But the second one that he talked about that was interesting was the fact that the shift between goods and services. That was kind of cool, just the way he put it, because when people were stuck at home, they were just buying stuff. We were all just buying stuff and we were getting stuff shipped to us on Instacart and DoorDash and Uber and Amazon. But then now what we're seeing is this massive, massive shift to services. Now we're traveling again, lodging, fuel, like all of this stuff where we're much more in person. People are getting haircuts again. And, you know, 2 years ago they weren't. So I thought that was pretty interesting. I think that's what's probably driving both real demand and a lot of inflation as well in some of these other sectors.
This is the counter question to the final question that we always ask. What are you optimistic about? What did you get a sense of what he was worried about?
I think everyone's just worried about uncertainty.
Yeah.
And the sort of the what is to come in macro, right? I think he was generally, yeah, I would say pretty circumspect about what the Fed is going to do and how the macro is going to react, as I think everyone should be generally. But I think some people, I think Ken took a little bit of comfort in the fact that the payments industry and the fintech industry clearly has some secular tailwinds behind it. If you just look at the breakdown of B2B payments, I think he spent a little bit of time going through this. A lot of it is still done over paper check. Well, you know, that's a pretty big fat TAM that you can go after if you are someone in the payment space building out new tools. I think that can counterbalance any sort of, you know, hard or soft or middle landing or whatever happens in 2023.
It's kind of hard to believe that. Like conceptually, I know that's true, that paper checks are still there. But in the world of sort of fintech B2B payments, the closed ecosystem, part of me is just like, how is this still possible? And the other part is like, oh, massive opportunity for us and, you know, other people to go after. More commentary based on there's just so much opportunity over anything.
Yeah. I look forward to taking a break from podcasting for the holiday seasons, but we'll be back for an even more exciting season 3 with many more hot takes.
Recession Proof is brought to you by Ramp. To find out more about Ramp and how we can help you control spend, save time, and automate busy work, visit ramp.com and then make sure to search for Recession Proof in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts or anywhere else podcasts are found. Make sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Ramp, thanks for listening.